Hello and welcome to the Waterways Ireland podcast series with me, Turtle Bunbury. In this series, we are exploring the rich history of Ireland's waterways from the beginning of recorded time to the present day. In the late 12th century, the waterways of Ireland became a battleground once again as a new force arrived on Irish shores in pursuit of land and glory, the Normans. Over 850 years after their arrival, we can still see the stages on which those Norman warriors played out their lives. The castles where they slept and ate, the harbours where they moored their boats, the churches where they worshipped, the graveyards where they lie buried. The Norman era is one that brings to mind an other world of chivalrous knights, if you believe that, and mighty stone castles that sprang up all along the rivers and lakes of Ireland. A determined people who would rule much of the known world, from Jerusalem to Sicily to the banks of the River Shannon. In the last episode, we looked at how Turlough O'Connor was dominating what we now know as the Shannon and Erne waterways during the 12th century, 900 years ago, diverting entire rivers when he needed to. We also mentioned his arch enemy, Tiernan O'Rourke, you might remember him, the one-eyed king of Breffni, and how Dermot McMurrough, king of Leinster, managed to nab Tiernan's wife, Dervagilla. Now, the upshot of all that was that after Turlough O'Connor's death, most of the other kings of Ireland ganged up on Dermot and kicked him off the island. So Dermot, the exiled king of Leinster, goes a-wandering in France and England and Wales, and one way or another he meets a chap by name of Richard de Clare, Earl of Pembroke, known to posterity as Strongbow. He's a French-speaking Norman warrior. He lives in the Welsh marshes. And Dermot goes to visit him and he makes Strongbow an offer he can't refuse. He says, "If you help me regain my kingdom, I will not only give you the hand in marriage of my beautiful daughter, Aoife," step forward, Aoife, and she was beautiful, "but I will also leave my kingdom to your children." And it's a no-brainer deal, says Strongbow. And that, we are told, is why the Normans came to Ireland. But let us back up a moment. Who are these Normans? Well, the Normans came from Normandy, and before that, they were Vikings who had settled in those parts of Normandy. So yes, we are sort of back to Vikings again, but Normans were Vikings with a dash of French panache. A Viking-Frankish hybrid who had kind of swapped longships for horses, and they knew how to ride horses really, really well. You may have heard of the Battle of Hastings 1066 and all that, when the Normans and William the Conqueror, they come over to England and they defeat the Saxon king and basically conquer England in a single battle. 100 or so years later, the grandsons and great-grandsons of those first Norman invaders into England, they turn their eyes west to Ireland. This is when Strongbow rustles up his mercenary force to come to Ireland. The advance guard sets off in 1169, and they basically shoot for the Viking spots, like Wexford on the Slaney, which they conquer in a few days. And then, 1170, Strongbow heads for Waterford at the mouth of the River Barrow, where he has the Viking king beheaded, and he then marries beautiful Aoife in Reginald's Tower. It is, of course, delightful to have a headless Viking at your marital ceremony. The thing is, these guys do come across as mobsters, basically, albeit full of chivalry and whatnot. All of those Norman knights who come to Ireland in the early days, some are from Wales, some from England, some from, you know, kind of French, and some are from what we now know as Belgium and the Netherlands. But they're all kind of interrelated. And as I say, there is more than a hint of the Corleone family about them all. Now, once they've got a foothold in Ireland, their mission is to secure control of as many of those lucrative port cities as possible. So, as I say, they've already nabbed Waterford and Wexford. But by the early 1170s, they've got hold of Cork and Dublin. So that means they now effectively control those ports and the rivers that come into them. The Liffey, the Lee, the Slaney, the Barrow, the Shore. And they're all the way up the east coast. Drogheda, Carrick, Fergus. And over the next 100, 200 years, they are basically going to develop those places, many of which started as Viking winter camps. They're going to develop them into proper medieval urban communities with walls and castles and markets and charters and all the makings of a modern town. The Normans are also going to do what the Vikings and the monks had done in earlier generations before. They're going to use the rivers as their principal transport routes. In part, that's going to help them to conquer the interior of the island, but it's also going to enable them to develop their trade links to get agricultural produce out from the fertile interior into those port cities from where it can be shipped off to the markets of Europe. Now, the most visible legacy of that era are the Norman castles. I should probably say Cambro-Norman or maybe Anglo-Norman, but let's just run with Norman for now. A lot of castles were built along Irish rivers during this period. Stone castles for the most part, but a lot of them had started as wood and then became stone. There was a lot of churches too, because this is the age of the Christian soldier, the crusader, the guys who fight with a prayer book in one hand and a razor-sharp sword in the other. Let's look at the River Barrow, for instance. Now, we know the Vikings were going up and down here a bit, fighting some battles at St. Mullins, a few raids here and there. But the Normans are going to make this river one of the main arteries of their new Irish colony. It's actually called the Lordship of Leinster. It's a sort of sequel to the Kingdom of Leinster. So, if you recall the deal that Dermot, King of Leinster, made with Strongbow, help me get my kingdom back and you can marry my daughter and I'll leave my kingdom to your children. Well, Strongbow and Aoife had two children, a boy and a girl, but the boy didn't make it to adulthood, which meant that the lordship of Leinster was now vested in their daughter, a girl called Isabel de Clare. Fast forward to the reign of Richard I, Richard the Lionheart, and he commands one of his knights, a guy called William Marshall, to marry Isabel de Clare. And it turns out to be something of a love match, and they become the power couple of their age. They go on a building frenzy, ports and lighthouses, churches and castles all over the sunny southeast. One of their biggest castles is on a piece of rising ground on the River Barrow. It is called Carharlock, and it's better known to you as Carlow. The castle here, well, actually there was a wooden one built in about 1181, but the stone castle, of which two towers and a massive connecting wall still survive, that was built over 800 years ago for William Marshall. It's a massive statement of intent from the Marshalls, from the Normans. We are here to stay. This stone fortress is going to control everything in this area. We have got mastery of the River Barrow, certainly this section, and the Burren too, that's a tributary of the Barrow, and all the roads in and out of the place, and our archers may have arrows ready to fire at all times. But don't worry, because we're also going to develop a wonderful market here in Carlow, and if you play by the rules and pay your taxes, all will be well. So that's the Anglo-Norman strategy. Establish fortifications along the waterways and control the rivers. Along the Barrow, there's going to be a whole bunch of mighty stone castles. Well, you can still see the remnants of the Motte Bailey at St. Mullins, but north of Carlow, you'll see stone castles along the river at Athy. There's Woodstock and White's Castle. There's another at Reban, another at Kildangan by Monastrevin, and an incredible Fitzgerald one at Lee near Port Arlington. So what you have is this string of formidable outposts along what was perhaps maybe 60 kilometres of the river. That becomes the border of the Pale. And in due course, there's going to be plenty more tower houses and castles built as a backup along that stretch over the course of the medieval period. So what you can see is that the Anglo-Norman, Cambro-Norman, whatever you call it, invasion of Ireland was a military takeover, no question. But there was a second string to the project, an economical one, because it's all about the money, right? In the 12th, 13th, 14th century, the way to make money is by farming. And these newcomers, as I say, we're just going to call them Normans for simplicity's sake, but they were as diverse a people as you or I, these new settlers seem to have been much better at farming than most of the people who were living in Ireland beforehand, certainly when it came to sheep. Wool is key. Sheep's wool is the hottest commodity in Europe, in medieval Europe. And the Normans are all over it. Among their core allies were some monks. We know them today as the Cistercian Order, the White Monks. This was a whole new type of monk. They're not like the bald-headed hermits and devout missionaries we've met before. Well, some of them might have been like that, but these guys are essentially farmer monks. They live in incredibly organized abbeys with dormitories and oratories and cloistered halls and kitchens and so on, all arranged around a neat square or maybe a quadrangle. It's not like those higgledy-piggledy early Celtic monasteries we talked about in previous episodes. The monks, the Cistercian monks in these places, they had proper work schedules and agendas and job titles and knowledge. They had so much knowledge. They're stuffed with knowledge about how to improve land and how to make the earth fertile and productive, or reclaim bad land and make it good. They know how to breed better sheep and cows, and how to plant crops and vegetables, and how to build fish farms and weirs and mills. And, you know, and as well as all that, they're plugged into an international European network. This is all important. They've got a European network headquartered in France, but they have those trade links and connections right into the heart of the European marketplace. The Cistercians were the first continental order to come to Ireland. They arrived in 1141 and established their mother house at Mellifont Abbey, where you might recall King Turlough O'Connor, he'd been knocking about there in the last episode. By 1161, they've got 11 abbeys in Ireland, including one at Boyle in County Roscommon. By 1189, there's 23 of these abbeys, including one on the River Barrow now at Monastrevin in County Kildare. By 1204, there's 31 Cistercian abbeys in Ireland, and the newest one is also on the Barrow. It's called Doisc Abbey, and it's located in Greigna Manor, County Kilkenny. If you're building an abbey in the medieval age, your site is going to need to have four or five things. A strong water supply to power the cloth and flour mills, pure and soft water for washing yarn, fertile land for raising your sheep, and access to the sea trading along the river. Those are all important, and also relative isolation. That was considered a positive in those days. Doisc Abbey in Greigna Manor, County Kilkenny, ticked all those boxes, not least because it is in a landscape of rich, freely drained soils, well suited to cultivation. The abbey was founded by William Marshall, our friend, the knight I mentioned earlier, who married Strongbow's daughter. In fact, he'd already built a Cistercian monastery at Tintern Abbey in Wexford. Anyway, if you are in the Greigna Manor area, do go and see Doisc Abbey, because it is arguably the finest of Ireland's abbeys, and a mill has now stood on this site since the Cistercian monks arrived almost 820 years ago. Ultimately, the Cistercians would have 38 abbeys across medieval Ireland with almost half a million acres. Those lands were spread out through a huge number of granges or outfarms. Monastrevin, for instance, the one I mentioned earlier, had 9 of these granges. And the Cistercians themselves, they operate a bit like a medieval corporation, a sort of corporate superpower, exporting their wool to places like Bruges in present-day Belgium, where it's turned into beautiful cloth, which was in turn then sold for a high price at medieval fairs across Europe. It's not just wool, though. Tanned leather and cattle hides are also in high demand. And tallow wax for candles, also hugely in demand. By the year 1290, so a couple of generations after the Normans arrive, approximately 51,000 cattle hides were being exported out of Ireland. That's a lot of cattle. During the Middle Ages, wool and tanned hides are the principal exports heading down the Barrow through Waterford and New Ross, and those two ports would export more wool than all other Irish ports combined. The point being, so with, you know, with Doishgabi and all those castles I mentioned between Carlow and Port Arlington, you can see how the Barrow was utterly key to all of this. That's the Barrow. What about the River Shannon? When did the Normans head to those parts? Well, 1184 is the immediate answer. At least by 1184, there are Norman knights and archers and horsemen knocking around Loch Derg. By the 1190s, they're starting to build castles. Again, some from wood, but others are made of stone, a material of permanence. We're sticking around. There is a Norman by name of Giraldus Cambrensis, Gerald of Wales. He's a sort of member of the Fitzgerald family. Anyway, he wrote an account of his visit to Ireland in 1185, and he was immediately impressed by the Shannon. He writes that it deservedly claims first rank both for its full and majestic stream, which flows through vast tracts of country, and for the abundance of fish within its waters. So the Normans are keen to get hold of that river, and they start to nab the region chunk by chunk. One of the principal knights is called William de Burgh. An ancestor of Chris, William de Burgh helped capture Thomond. That's the Kingdom of Limerick. He captures it for the Normans in 1195, and as his reward, he is granted the south bank of the Shannon all the way from Limerick up to Loch Derg and a little bit north again. He's got the O'Briens on the other side. Now, to protect his lands, he's going to need some castles. Indeed, de Burgh, or Burke, as his ancestors will become. He builds two of the first castles in County Galway. One was at Meelick, near the Victoria Lock on the Shannon, very close to the point where the provinces of Munster, Leinster and Connacht meet. You can still see the earthworks there. Then, perhaps 10 kilometres downriver from Meelick, de Burgh builds a motte and bailey at Portumna. The castle there today is on the same site, but it's a 17th century castle, although also built by the de Burghs. So these two castles, built in about 1203, 1204, they're going to represent a new era, the first thrust of the Normans into the Kingdom of Connacht. By 1216, the Normans have got a castle at Killaloo, that's Brian Boru's old headquarters. And oh yes, they've whacked one up in Limerick City, an especially big one, King John's Castle, which you can visit today. It's on King's Island, a bang smack on the spot where the Vikings had their camp a few generations earlier. This formidable Shannonside fortress was named for King John, as in the bad guy in the Robin Hood movies, a man who gave the whole King John concept such a bad rap that 800 years on, they still haven't had a King John II. One thing about castles, not everyone likes them. To this day, some see them as horrible bastions of conquest, places in which chainmail-clad bullies lived securely and then came out every now and then to torment the people, steal their crops, their wives and daughters, tax them, whip them and so on. And that is a valid point, although needless to say, I'm not saying we should start tumbling our castles. But there is also a great complexity about castles in Ireland because, well, literally thousands of them are going to be built over the course of the medieval period. We call them castles, but they were also houses, fortified houses. If you had any influence or money in the medieval period, you needed to live in a house that you could defend. It doesn't matter if you're an Irishman, a Welshman, a Norman, or a Cockney merchant on the make from London. You're going to make a strong stone house, ideally with narrow windows you can shoot arrows out of, and a castellated roof that you can, again, you can hide your archers behind. And well, if you're rich enough or you have government support, a moat and extra walls and maybe a few more towers and so on. Take Loch Derg, for instance. If you count up all the Norman keeps and fortified mansions and tower houses around the loch and say, well, they're all castles, and I'd agree with you, well, that means that there are almost 40 castles on Loch Derg alone. And they were not all built by Norman knights, but some of them were, because in 1237, as the annals of Loch Key record, the barons of Erin, that's the Normans, came into Connacht and commenced to build castles in it. In other words, the Normans, these descendants of Strongbow and his warriors, these guys have crossed the Shannon. They are led by Richard de Burgh, a son of the fellow we mentioned earlier. And it's taken them a lot of fighting to get there, at least 10 years of fighting, I believe. But now they've got a grip, they're going to start building castles at all the strategic fords and crossing points. As it happens, 1237 is actually kind of the high watermark for those Normans on the Shannon, because they don't really get a decent hold on the waterway. Part of that is because of the Irish chieftains, the Gaelic lords, they're kicking back. A whopper of a battle is fought in 1256 amid the drumlins of County Cavan, just west of the Shannon Erne waterway. The annals say that the Burkes and their allies assembled an army of 20,000, which is surely an exaggeration, but however many it wasn't enough because they got beat. 14 years later, things reached a crescendo, this is 1270, with another massive battle fought on a ford of the River Shannon near Leitrim village, and it's another huge victory for the Irish, commanded by Hugh MacPhailim O'Connor, the King of Connacht. Having won that battle, they then burn down every enemy castle they can find, including one that was in progress at Roscommon, and that kind of checks the Anglo-Norman English advance in the region for a while. I generalise enormously, but the point is that the Gaelic-Irish lords have by no means rolled over. And in terms of castles, just because the Normans have been kicked out, or they're really English at this point, but it doesn't mean that people stop building castles. In fact, the Gaelic-Irish lords think castles are a good idea. They start to adapt the tower houses for their own use. A bunch of tower houses on Loch Derg were built by the Kennedy family, or O'Kennedy, who are based in Ormond on the Tipperary side of the loch. They have a long-standing on-again, off-again pact going with one of the main Norman families. That's the Earls of Ormond, the Butler family. And the Kennedy castles are all sort of in and around Nina, including those at Dromineer and Gary Kennedy, but there were, as I say, many others. If we shift north up the Shannon to Loch Ree, we're going to find less Norman castles because, as I say, they weren't wildly successful at conquering those parts. They do, however, get Athlone. In 1210, the same year that King John's castle in Limerick is built by a guy called John de Grey, Bishop of Norwich. Actually, Bishop de Grey, he's an extraordinary man. He's King John's main man in Ireland and one of his all-time favourite advisors. He is a military man, a sword-swinging bishop with a mission. He builds the original stone fortress on a man-made hill at Athlone, the walls of which still stand today. It was built so that the English could control this crossing. It's a vital crossing point on the River Shannon. And also, it's going to provide the Normans or the English with a bridgehead for whenever the English king and his army wish to advance into Connacht. As I say, the 12-sided keep, it's also known as a donjon at Athlone, that dates to this time. And I believe the original castle even had a moat. Now, we're inching towards the finish of this one, but I'm going to try and bring the River Erne into this story too, because what Bishop Grey was trying to do, or what he seems to be trying to do, was a hugely ambitious attempt to conquer both Connacht and the northwest of Ireland, or at least Fermanagh and Monaghan. Maybe conquer is too strong a word, but he was absolutely bringing the fight to the Irish. We've already got the castles at Limerick and Athlone. He fortifies Clonmacnoise on the Shannon, and then he builds three Mott and Bailey castles within present-day Ulster. There's one at Clonus and two more along the Erne at Beleek and Coilishka. These are the first castles in that part of Ireland, I mean, when we talk about the Maguires, but the Maguires won't build Enniskillen Castle for another 200 years or more. And as I say, I think Bishop Grey's plan was that he wanted to use these forts to launch attacks on the Ulster clans. But, well, it's not going to work. The Irish are going to overrun each of those Mott and Bailey fortresses very quickly. And the luckless Norman guys who are garrisoned there, they're going to be either killed or sent packing. But if you happen to be on the Ulster Canal, the good news is that you can still see the remnants of Bishop Grey's Mott and Bailey fortress in Clonus. It's right above the town. I understand it was actually built on the site of an older monument, which doesn't surprise me because Clonus is a truly remarkable place and well worth a visit. I also mentioned Coil Ushka. Where's that? Well, the jury's kind of out, but for those who know that part of the world, Coil means narrow or slender. So it's generally assumed to have been at a narrow part of Loch Earn, with the two favourite contenders being at Castle Caldwell, and the other is right at the spot where the River Earn leaves Lower Loch Earn. Anyway, that's about as northerly a part of Ireland as the Normans ever got, certainly in the northwest. There are a few other spots in the west that you should bear in mind if you'd like to see some medieval architecture from this sort of early medieval Norman period. The Cistercian Abbey at Boyle in County Roscommon, I mentioned earlier, it's an absolute beauty. It was founded on land donated by the McDermott family, and it is on the River Boyle that's part of the Shannon. Then there is the home of the McDermotts themselves, McDermott Castle, a postcard perfect castle set on a verdant green island in the southwest corner of Loch Key. The annals recorded a very magnificent kingly residence on this spot in 1184. Some say it's much older than that. But what you see now is a 19th century rebuild of it by the architect John Nash, who was commissioned to redevelop it as a summer house or a folly, but it is also an absolute cracker. And then there's Rindoon. Rindoon on Loch Ree. Rindoon, which is, well, it's built on a fortified peninsula. It's called St. John's Point on the western shore, the Roscommon side of Loch Ree. Oh, the silent, romantic waters of Loch Ree. Mind you, they haven't always been silent and romantic. In 1201, for instance, there was a mega battle fought here between Normans and Connacht men, another bad day out for the French speakers. But the settlement at Rindoon is a podcast in itself. It is an incredible Anglo-Norman sort of citadel, a walled town. Its earliest part was actually a priory hospital built just outside the walls, which is much older than the castle and was dedicated to St. John the Baptist and may well have been started by the O'Connor kings, who were bringing pilgrims across the loch at that time and on down to Clonmacnoise and Cong and Tuam. And the ancient wood beside it is actually called St. John's Wood, in a further nod to the cult of St. John the Baptist. But Rindoon had everything. It had a castle, a very safe harbour. It's the most sheltered place on the lake in poor weather, as I know from personal experience. It had a 500-metre town wall, a street full of timber-framed houses, a church, a market, a windmill, a fish pond, a rabbit warren. The Normans loved their rabbits. It had a deer park too. The Normans also big fans for deers. So that's the kind of Norman big five game tick list right there. It was supposed to become a new town, a city even, and it got the king's backing. The castle was a royal castle, as in the Lord of Rindoon. The Lord of Rindoon was also Henry III, King of England. Not that he ever visited, mind you. He did somehow swing a deal with the O'Connor kings in 1227, by which he was allowed to build the place. And it had a town council and a constable. The first constable was a guy called Philip de Angelo, reputedly a grandson of one of the guys who came to Ireland with Strongbow. Philip de Angelo had a pretty checkered past. He'd been declared an outlaw at one stage, but he was evidently back on side by the time this place was built and he was appointed its constable. In fact, he wasn't there for very long when the O'Connors decided to attack it. It is hard to know how badly they trashed it, but The Normans, or the English, started building it up again, and then in 1233, King Henry III, Lord of Rendun, he pulls the plug. He orders the masons and the labourers to down tools. The government in Dublin has decided that the royal castle and the bridge at Athlone is a much more sensible investment. So they called a halt to the Rendun project. The place kind of limped on for another 80 years or so with patchwork repairs, but it was attacked again and again, and in the early 1300s it was abandoned in its entirety, which is why it's so cool, because it's like an Anglo-Norman ghost town. And when you go there, you can sort of imagine its heyday, when there were apparently 600 people living there, boat builders and carpenters and shoemakers and so on. Okay, so the clock is against me, but dear listener, I do want to say that if you are on or around the Royal Canal or the Grand Canal, there are some cracking Anglo-Norman castles within easy range of those waterways. If you're on the Royal Canal Greenway, you get to see the magnificent castle at Maynooth. But there are others, like nearby Moygaddy Castle. It's a sweet wee tower where barn owls like to chill, so don't be disturbing them. But if you're Enfield, then you're pretty close to the amazing Trim Castle, which Mel Gibson used to great effect in Braveheart almost 30 years ago. Ouch. There is so much more we could touch on here. The Augustinians, for starters, but I think you've probably had your fill of medieval monks for now. One last thing. It's always strangely reassuring to read about the climate being crazy in centuries past. Well, in 1252, there was a great wind, which was followed by this report in the annals. Great heat and drought prevailed in this summer, so that people crossed the principal rivers of Ireland with dry feet. Egads, well, on that note, until the next time, as the Normans might say, à bientôt and bonne chance, see you soon and good luck. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Waterways Through Time. You'll find more episodes on waterwaysireland.org or on Alexa, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find my archive of historical stories, mostly Irish, at turtlebunbury.com. My sincere thanks to series producer Ali Bunbury and technical producer Mary Burke.